Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I am your aptly named host. And we are back again live from the Foundation Center in New York City, our second show in Foundation Center Month on Nonprofit Radio. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd be thrown into chirokinesthesia if you handed me the idea that you missed today's show. Getting to know community foundations. They're closer to the work in the community than private foundations are. But what else distinguishes community foundations? And what are they talking about? What's trending? How can you build a relationship with yours and tap into donor-advised funds? On the second show in Foundation Center Month on Nonprofit Radio, our guests are David Rosato from the Foundation Center and Kaberi Banerjee-Murthy with Brooklyn Community Foundation. We'll take questions from our audiences. We have our studio audience, thanks very much for all being here. And we have a live stream audience on YouTube as well. Glad you're with us, YouTube. We're gonna get your questions also. You can put them in the comments. I've got giveaways later, so keep your phones handy. And that includes our YouTube, our live stream audience. You're included in the giveaways. On Tony's Tech 2, it's Foundation Center Month. I'll say more about that. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full service fundraising, data-driven and technology-enabled. Tony.ma/Pursuant. Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, WegnerCPAs.com. By Telos, turning credit card processing into your passive revenue stream, Tony.ma/TonyTelos. And by Text to Give, mobile donations made easy, text NPR to 444-999. I'm excited to welcome our second panel to Nonprofit Radio Month at the Foundation Center. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Kaberi,
seated next to me, Kaberi Banerjee-Murthy, is Vice President of Programs at the Brooklyn Community Foundation. She leads their $4 million grant-making programs and advocacy work around racial justice. The focus of her work is youth of color, immigrant rights, and criminal justice. She has more than 15 years of philanthropic leadership at local, regional, and national foundations, including Crown Family Philanthropies in Chicago, Picower Foundation in New York, and Jane's Trust and Cox Trust in Boston. The foundation is at bcfny.org and BKLYN Foundation. David Rosato is the Member Services Manager for CF Insights. That's a service of Foundation Center focused on community foundation research and benchmarking. He oversees operations, including its data architecture, and responds to requests for support and knowledge from member and non-member visitors to CF Insights. At the Foundation Center, he's worked on all aspects of data acquisition and grants indexing for community foundations. The org is at cfinsights.org and at CF Insights. He's at David Rosato 84. Kaberi, David, again, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you.
Yeah.
David, let's start with you. I don't know.
Sure.
Am I overstating it if I say you're the nation's expert on community foundations? I mean, you have a ton of data on community foundations.
Yeah, you could say I'm among them if you want. Sure.
Among? Okay. It's a small and select group.
Yeah, right. It's a, yeah.
Very distinguished.
It's an elite group, yeah. Sure, yeah. No, we, if I could talk a little bit about CF Insights in general. So CF Insights, the CF and CF Insights stands for Community Foundation, as you might imagine. And we do maintain a database of primarily financial and operational data that's self-reported by the field to us. And you know, one question that we ask, and it's kind of, you know, it's a tagline, but it's also a question that we ask, and that is, you know, what if each community foundation could know what all community foundations collectively know? And so that's what the database is there for. It serves a dual purpose. You could say that it does that. So you know, one of the main purposes is that it helps us provide a snapshot of what's happening in the community foundation field. So how it's growing, you know, what are some of the key differences between community foundations of different sizes and how they operate and how they're built, basically.
How many community foundations are you collecting data from?
So annually we collect data on around a third of the field, so about 275 community foundations do the survey that we do. And we do capture the activity of all the, you know, all the largest in the country, but we do have a mix of a lot of the smaller ones and a lot of the, you know, ones that are kind of in the middle as well.
Okay, and what are you doing with all this data?
Yeah, so the snapshot is available at a website called, it's a Columbus Survey Results Dashboard. I could talk a little bit more about the survey that we do, but it's columbussurvey.cfinsights.org. And that snapshot is...
Right. You better say that URL a little slower. This is
sure.
This is where the database is?
So this is where
they can access the raw data?
This is where they can access some of the raw data, but this is where they get a snapshot of, there's analysis there, there are a lot of graphs and visualizations and narrative about the data itself.
Okay, say it slower.
So columbussurvey.cfinsights.org.
columbussurvey.cfinsights.org.
Yep. Okay. That's right, okay. Yeah. And the reason it's called the Columbus Survey is because it was actually started by the Columbus Foundation 30 years ago, and it was taken over by CF Insights 10 years ago. So we do provide that snapshot, but it also is a way for our member community foundations, of which we have about 130 of those, who can sign onto the database and perform benchmarking against each other in a variety of different ways. So they can query that data to look for other community foundations that are, you know, roughly their asset size or roughly their age or have a similar staffing makeup to kind of compare their performance against those other community foundations. But, you know, CF Insights is not just that database. We do also do a lot of research on trends happening in the field. So we're, you know, I'm constantly going to conferences around the country that are community foundation focused. And, you know, I get to hear a lot of the conversations that are happening, and they usually are the seeds for some of the research that we do around the field.
Do you get the frequent traveler points as you're flying around?
I do get some of those.
You get to keep those?
Okay. I do get to keep those, yeah. It's one of the perks, yeah.
That's an important perk.
Yeah.
All right. So community foundation members can ask questions about what, like funding trends, what you think may be underfunded, what their peers are doing, things like that?
Yeah, so they can ask questions about what their peers are doing. It's really more based on the operating model of the community foundation, less so than specific issue areas that they're funding. So, you know, if there's a, you know, they might want to compare themselves to other community foundations that are similarly focused on donor advised funds as they are, to just kind of get at, you know, what is their growth rate over time, to see whether or not they might be keeping pace or something like that. But it does go beyond that, because we do collect data on, you know, the revenue streams that are collected by community foundations as well, to get at some of the operational differences.
Okay, what are some of those revenue streams?
So a lot of it is going to be administrative fees that are assessed on funds. So, you know, if a fund holder, you know, contributes to a fund, they do get assessed a fee on that, and so the community foundation collects that.
Okay.
Some of them are transaction-based, some of them are, you know, it could be investment income. So some of these funds are permanent funds that are set up and invested in various ways, so some of that, you know, interest income as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other sources of revenue? I think that's interesting. Common sources of revenue for community foundations?
Yeah, I mean, those are really the main ones. Yeah, admin fees are going to be the main driver, and it's usually going to be the bulk of what the revenues are at a community foundation.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We'll come back, because I want to talk about some of the trends and what you're seeing. Kaberi, let's turn to you. Acquaint us, not too long.
Not the long version.
Brooklyn Community Foundation, your endowment fund, your donor-advised fund program.
Absolutely. Yeah. So at Brooklyn Community Foundation, we're the Burroughs Foundation in Brooklyn. We started about 9 years ago. So in 2009, we were a conversion foundation from a bank. So we do have an endowment, so we're a little unusual from the trends that I think are being talked about in terms of how many assets, what our assets are, and how they're divided amongst the different ways of giving. The big piece of it for us as a community foundation is about 5 years ago, when we wanted to be able to really think about how we engaged with our community, what we did is we, instead of having the board sort of close doors and decide for themselves what they wanted to be doing, we actually went with 1,000 conversations with people in Brooklyn to ask our community what they wanted from their community foundation. And so as I think we think here about like how community foundations are different, I think one of the things that we've been really trying to do is make sure that we're accountable to the community that we serve, and that is the community of Brooklyn. So both in terms of the donations being given to the foundation as well as the grants that we're giving to the community, and being able to really change the hierarchies and the ways in which philanthropy usually shows up. So we do about half of our staff community fund grant making via staff-led grant making and half via constituent-led grant making. So that's being able to bring communities into the decision-making process and have them actually make the recommendations to the board on how the foundation's allocations get shared with the community.
How diverse is Brooklyn?
Super diverse. Yeah.
Everybody's not from New York.
Yeah. I mean, so now my communications person's going to kill me because I don't have these facts at my fingertips. But it is 70% immigrant and of color. And so as we think about like the overall diversity of Brooklyn, very diverse. And as we think about the size of Brooklyn, if Brooklyn was a city unto itself, it would be the fourth largest city in the United States. So even though it is a, you know, one of five boroughs of New York and it sort of gets fed into the New York numbers, Brooklyn unto itself is A, very diverse, and B, very large. And so as we think about the work that, and despite that, only 4% of philanthropic dollars from the New York philanthropic scene actually get into Brooklyn, serving Brooklyn nonprofits.
4%.
4%. And so as a community foundation, one of the other pieces that we're really committed to is shining a light on all of the amazing work that's happening in Brooklyn, because we have 2,000-3,000 nonprofits that are doing exceptional work in Brooklyn. And we're also wanting to make sure that we're able to support the organizations that may be smaller.
We have an accelerator program
for the nonprofits that includes capacity building, technical assistance. We seed incubators, and we actually have them within our foundation space, and we built our space to be able to hold them. And we have a newsletter that goes out not just to our grantees, but to nonprofits that are doing any type of, well, they can go out to anyone, but most likely, most important for those who are doing any type of work in the borough to be able to know of opportunities that they can take advantage of. So all of those things are the ways in which we want to be able to be in deep partnership with the nonprofits that we serve within Brooklyn, and also make sure that other people are learning about that. So both other foundations, individual donors, being able to connect partner organizations with one another, ensuring that we're really trying to think around the grant making as one tool in our toolkit, but knowing that there are a whole host of tools that we're able to use.
And I do want to talk some about connecting potential grantees with donors.
Yep.
How our nonprofit audience, you know, can start that relationship.
Yep.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Great,
David. How common is all this work that Brooklyn Community Foundation is doing in terms of, you know, a community foundation's role in its community, like as an incubator, connecting grantees to donors, etc. What are you seeing as the general role in the communities?
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you asked that, because one of the kind of basic tenets that you might hear in the field when you speak to folks that are working in a community foundation is that if you've seen one community foundation, you've seen one community foundation, which is just not true. And that's where a lot of our work comes from, is that we're able to go and actually compare some of the work of some community foundations across the country.
So we can make some generalizations.
So we can try our best, yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, you know, in terms of some of the work that Brooklyn Community Foundation is doing, you are seeing a bit of a shift across the field from a lot of community foundations that are interested in moving from, you know, kind of a financial asset manager to more of an active player within their community. So they do that in very different ways. You know, it could be, you know, self-operated initiatives that they run to either try to affect impact in, you know, graduation rates or workforce development
that. Some initiatives on their own.
Initiatives
as
on their own,
opposed to funding
self-funded,
orgs that are doing the work. Doing some of the work on their own.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are you doing that in Brooklyn?
We have a couple different things that we're doing. We have the Restorative Justice Project, where we're partnering with four organizations that are working in four Brooklyn schools to be able to move from punitive practice to restorative practice. And then we also have an evaluator who's being able to take a look at what we're learning and be able to share that with the field. So that's very different than sort of like the request for proposals, LOI process of responsive.
I got to believe that there are nonprofits in Brooklyn that could have done that work themselves with your funding.
Mm-hmm.
Why take the initiative on yourself to to do it directly.
So this is one of the things that we learned from our Brooklyn Insights process, right, is that people were worried about young people and around overcriminalization and around schools. And so that was sort of a way for us to think around how being able to look at restorative justice within the schools, be able to reduce suspensions, reduce disciplinary rates, keep students in the schools, be able to break the school to prison pipeline, and be able to actually experiment, right? Like, that's one of the things that philanthropy is able to do. We don't necessarily, they're not public dollars where you have to prove that everything will work, and I think there needs to be a little bit of risk in philanthropy to ensure that we're utilizing our dollars to their highest end goal. And so what we wanted to do was be able to experiment to see what restorative practices would work and what, you know, and have sort of like four mini experiments running side by side. They're absolutely not in competition with one another, but we have a cohort that comes together. They're able to support one another, strategize with one another, and then and support one another.
So you can be more nimble if you're doing the work yourself.
Exactly.
Versus going through four or more organizations.
And I think the, yes.
They might feel like they're competing.
Right, right, right. And I think the other piece of it for us is, you know, I talk about our cycle of engagement or our theory of change, which is that our grant making allows us to learn from the community. And what that feeds into is advocacy. So part of the work that we're doing within the Restorative Justice Project is also being able to advocate on behalf of policy change. So we were able to have city council folks come do a circle with our young people, have an intergenerational circle in one of our schools. We had a number of folks from different boroughs come with some of their staff members from their teams, learn about the Restorative Justice Project and the impact that it's happening within the schools. And then we were able to have that site visit the week before the city council was meeting to think about what the repercussions were of a stabbing incident that happened in the Bronx. And one of the outcomes of that was that when the city council allocated resources, they made an $8 million allocation all to restorative practice and not into more like metal detectors for the schools, right? So we're thinking not just about the schools and the youth and the teachers and the administrators that will be that will benefit from the program in their school, but also what's the higher end goal of being able to think around the evaluation and the learnings that can impact the field and how that can move to systems level change and being able to get resources from the public sector, which will always dwarf philanthropic dollars, to be able to move those dollars into things that we can learn.
David, how common is this, the community advocacy? I mean, I gotta believe it is.
Yeah, it's growing a bit. You know, it depends on the community foundation, of course, and it depends on what the needs of the community are. I think this is actually a pretty powerful example of what differentiates a community foundation from others, is that they're able to, you know, to learn from the communities in which they're embedded. You know, they've been there for a while. They have board members that are representatives of the community, and so, you know, with their donors that they're learning about what the needs are,
now,
they can actually be nimble.
Okay, but why is it that private foundations just aren't as connected? I mean, private foundations could have board members who are among the community. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to understand just how they've evolved differently. Why is it that private foundations aren't as close to their communities as community foundations are?
That's a good question. I maybe can present a theory. I don't know if I'd give you a really good answer to that.
You're among the nation's experts. There are only two or three of you, so.
Well, I mean, yeah, I would just say that maybe a private foundation would be a little bit more single issue, maybe. You know, it depends on the foundation, of course, but, you know, there might be specific issues that they're set up to respond to, whereas a community foundation is more broad-based in terms of their focus, and it also
evolves.
Yeah, the
mission is community. Versus a narrower focus. Okay.
Yeah, so it's not like they're focused necessarily on one or two things, but they're focused on every need of the community, which also evolves as the community evolves. And I think that's one of the main advantages of a community foundation, is that they're embedded there and they get to learn over time and react to it.
What's some more that you're seeing in terms of role in the community?
Yeah, so role in the community. So I mentioned the initiatives, but you know, you're seeing a little bit more activity in the advocacy space. But there also are a lot of community foundations that may play a more passive role as well. So they're not necessarily going out and advocating for specific policy change, but they might bring together local leaders who are experts in a specific issue and, you know, host a roundtable or something like that. So I think that's one of the ways in which a community foundation is making their presence known among, you know, not just the constituents in the community, but also potential donors as well, who see that these are experts, that these are the ones, you know, these are the guys who might, who know who the main players are on a specific issue, and so some dollars might be better, you know, better directed if it went in that direction, and then they can work with the community foundation, the donor can, to determine who the best, who the most equipped organizations are to solve a specific issue.
I'd love to hear from our 100+ audience members if you want to contribute. What is your community foundation doing, or what do you wish your community foundation would be doing? We'll throw it to our panel to see if those suggestions make sense, or if you're bringing in something new that we haven't talked about yet. What's happening in your community, should be happening, or what is your community foundation doing? Let's bring it in. Anybody in the live audience here? Anybody here representing a community foundation? No, everybody's in a nonprofit. They're all 501c3, yes, grantee type organization, live in the studio. Okay, but on YouTube, our live stream, bring it in. If you want to join the conversation, please do. And what else? Anything else trending that you're seeing?
Yeah,
you got more. Every time I say, what else?
There's always more. Yeah, I guess in terms of the work being done, there's a little bit of a growing interest in something called impact investing. And so folks may be familiar with that, but essentially what they are low-cost loans that are given to either a nonprofit organization or perhaps even a for-profit organization with a social purpose. And these low-cost loans, they're given with the expectation of the return of that loan, of course. And so what it might create is a little bit of a cycle. So those funds might come back and they might be recycled for, a loan to another organization that's affecting some sort of change in the community. Those impact investments tend to be focused on, economic development, workforce development, but not necessarily so. It just seems to be, the most common example that I've seen. Two very visible examples that are pretty easy to look up and learn more about are Go Atlanta, Go ATL, which is from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta, and Benefit Chicago from the Chicago Community Trust with Calvert Impact Capital and I think the MacArthur Foundation. So they give these low-cost loans to organizations that are either looking to become sustainable or to attain a specific impact goal. So, create 300 jobs or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's something new.
Kaberi, are we seeing that in Brooklyn?
We are having conversations around impact investing. I think a lot of foundations are thinking around the other 95%, right? So like the payout of a foundation is 5% and trying to think about the 95%. For us, what we've actually looked at is divesting. And so making sure that none of our money is invested in issues that are antithetical to the issues that we're working on, right? So we divested from predatory lending, private prisons, guns. Those are all things that are challenges that we are trying to address via the grant making, and so we don't want to be making money off of something that we're trying to address on the other side. And so I think as we think about our racial justice lens, we're really wanting to ensure that we're using that lens to analyze and make decisions at every part of the foundation. So whether it's the investing, whether it's the grant making, whether it's our operations, making sure that we're as solid as possible in thinking about how we show up to do the work.
Who does the investing for your endowment fund? Do you have an outside investor?
We have an outside investor that does that.
And we have
a finance committee is the one that oversees that on a quarterly basis.
So it's probably an investment policy statement that the advisor has to follow. David, is that common?
Is it usually an outside advisor model? Yeah. I would say that's probably more common than having somebody internally.
Than doing it internally.
What else?
What else is happening in Brooklyn that you think
Others could know about. I mean, I think one of the things that's important to raise up about the Community Foundation, I'm sure we'll get into this more on the as we get to the DAF side, but within our community fund, so we're a little bit different in terms of 2/3 of our grant making is done via our community fund and only 1/3 of it is done via our DAFs. But even within our community fund, we have about 8 different programs. One of our programs is called the Spark Program, and that's an opportunity, like I said, to be able to share our decision making with the community. community. And so this is a space where every year 35 folks from all over Brooklyn come together. They read through all of the applications of organizations that are approaching the foundation. Last year we had 150, this year we have about similar. They approach the foundation looking for telling us about what future plans they have, and we're really looking to be able to select organizations that are showcasing some of the most exciting work happening in Brooklyn. And one of the things that's really nice about that is that it not only allows us to be able to have an open process to have folks come in and help advise and make decisions as to where these dollars are going, but it also allows folks to be able to understand the breadth of work that's happening within the foundation and within the sector.
I'm gonna use this as a transition.
Go for it.
Approaching the Community Foundation.
Yes.
For funding.
Okay.
Because everybody here in the live audience is
interested
is
in that.
Is in that situation, and I'm guessing a lot of the live stream audience is too.
Yeah.
So, I'm a nonprofit. I'm a potential grantee. I know that I have a Community Foundation local, but I've never really developed a relationship. Mm-hmm. How do I start?
I mean, there are a lot of different ways to do it. I think one of the best things to do is to be able to get onto the eBlast. I'm sure most community foundations have this. We have one that goes out. It shares all of the work that's happening at the foundation, including connecting you to all sorts of other opportunities that are open to nonprofits within the sector. So that's sort of a passive way to get a sense of the opportunities that are coming. I think the other piece of it is to be able to look on the website, see what the foundation is funding. I know we talked a little bit about many community foundations tend to be broad tent, everything under the sun. Yeah. Brooklyn Community Foundation is a little bit different insofar as we have a number of different opportunities that are focused on what the community told us that they were most interested in. So we have our Invest in Youth portfolio, which is our largest portfolio. We have a Neighborhood Strength program that's investing very specifically in Crown Heights. We have our Accelerator program that's looking to like undergird and strengthen the entire nonprofit sector. And so being able to take a look and just do your research about like, do you fit into any of those spaces and how to approach the foundation in the normal way.
Now the research is key.
Research is super key.
A lot of, I've heard, and I know this, it's unfortunately common that foundations, whether community or otherwise, get a lot of inquiries around interest areas that they don't work in, that the foundation doesn't fund. And the organization would have saved itself a lot of time and anxiety if it had just done some basic research at the beginning and ended up not approaching the foundation. You're not going to make the foundation drift turn direction from its mission. So you that basic research is essential.
I think that's key. I do think the other piece of it, though, and I think this is also true of community foundations of being responsive, especially to crisis. One of the things that we set up right at the day after the presidential elections is we created a four-year commitment to safeguard Brooklyn's immigrant communities. And so we created a four-year, currently $2 million immigrant rights fund. And so that is something that we weren't necessarily funding deeply before. We had an immigrant youth and family strand within our Invest in Youth portfolio. So we had familiarity with it. We knew about that space of work. But as we made the commitment, as we've deepened our commitment over time, we've gotten to know that area a lot better than we did when we necessarily entered into the work. And I think one of the important pieces of being a community foundation is we still need to know all of the work that's happening within the nonprofit sector. And so we are constantly having calls with folks that may not necessarily be in the wheelhouse of one of our given programs, but it's our responsibility to be able to understand the work that's happening, both to be able to like respond in crisis and be aware, but also to be able to advise our donors, right? And to be able to say, we may not necessarily specifically fund health, but if we have a donor that's interested in health, we need to know enough to be able to advise appropriately. And that's one of the places where Spark is really helpful to us, is that it's a place where, despite the fact that we have commitments in these given funding areas, we are creating a portal where everyone is able to approach the foundation to be able to go before the Spark committee to talk about the work that we're doing.
You're open.
So we're open in that way.
Okay, I have to stop you.
Yes.
I have to do a little business.
Go for it.
We're going to continue this.
Excellent.
This is what I think people are most interested in, is how do I approach? Mm-hmm. And then we are going to talk about when you were the DAFs, the donor advised funds. That's coming up. How do you connect with those, with the donor advised fund owners and donors to to encourage them to give to your organization. I got to do a little business. Pursuant, their new ebook is Fast Nonprofit Growth, Stealing from the Startups. They take secrets from the fastest growing corporate startups and apply those methods and best practices to your nonprofit. The resource is free, as all the resources are at Pursuant, and you'll find this ebook on the listener landing page. It's at tony.ma/pursuant, with a capital P. tony.ma/pursuant, capital P. You'll get their ebook. Wegner CPAs, they have something new on their blog. It's called New Revenue Recognition Standard. Will it impact me? Okay, that sounds like a real sleeper. Not even something, I mean, I wouldn't even necessarily read that at night. But the point is, that's where you want your CPA's heads to be, right? In the tax code. There is this new thing, this new revenue recognition standard, and it does impact you. It could very well impact you. It's all around how you categorize your donations. You're all getting gifts. That's what this is all about. This is where you want your CPAs to be, in the tax code, buried, mired in the new revenue recognition standard. Check out, you can get and you can check out Wegner CPAs as well at wegnercpas.com. And if you want to go deeper, you click resources, then blog. Telos, for credit card processing. If you know businesses that take credit cards that are already supporting you, through the months of the show, I mean, I've had the show for years, but they've been a sponsor for like 6 months or so. I've been reading testimonials from nonprofits that have referred businesses, from businesses that are using Telos for their credit card processing. Everybody is satisfied. What happens is the nonprofit, get a long tail of passive revenue, because you get 50% of the revenue that Telos earns from all the credit card processes that it completes for the businesses you refer. So you refer businesses, they use Telos for their credit card processing, you get 50% of the fees Telos earns. That's the point. Long tail of passive revenue. The landing page for listeners is at tony.ma/TonyTelos. And text to give. You'll get more revenue because they make giving very simple. If your donors can send a text message, they can give. If you've been thinking about changing providers, or if you're thinking about doing a text to give campaign, check out text to give. Very simple. You text NPR for Nonprofit Radio, NPR to 444-999, and that'll get you a special listener offer and info on text to give. It's time for Tony's Take Two, and I want to spend more time talking about the Foundation Center and Foundation Center Month on Nonprofit Radio. This is our second episode. We're here all month. You can see this backdrop is here in the library all month at Foundation Center. They're so devoted to Nonprofit Radio. Thank you to the Foundation Center. And Nonprofit Radio is devoted to bringing Foundation Center info to our listeners, to our 13,000 listeners each week. There's a Foundation Center staff member on every panel, all four shows this month. And there's someone from a foundation related to the topic we're talking about as well. Next week, we're going to be talking about private foundations. And Susan Shiroma is going to be the Foundation Center panelist on that panel. So we are spending the month at the Foundation Center. Join us. If you go to tony.ma/FCMonth, you got to use a capital F and a capital C and a capital M. tony.ma/FCMonth, then you can see what the other two shows are that are coming up the next two Fridays. Very grateful to the Foundation Center for hosting us the whole month of September. All right, let's go back to our panel. It's David Rosato. He's the Vice President of Programs at the Brooklyn Community Foundation. No, that's Kaberi. Kaberi is the Vice President of Programs at the Brooklyn Community Foundation. And David Rosato is the Member Services Manager at CF Insights. All right. Sometimes I get so carried away. So what exactly? We were talking about
Spark and allowing portals that allow all organizations to approach a community foundation.
Now, is that common? I'm gonna ask you. Are most community foundations open to conversations about what's happening in the community, even if it's not an area that they're currently funding? Or do you think that you're unusual in that?
I would hope that all community foundations are open to that conversation,
yeah,
because it's important.
I'm going to ask David, but I want to ask you about.
I think yes, and I think partly because many community foundations are big tent, and so they may be trying to support a little bit of everything.
Okay.
And so being able to know a little bit about everything is important if you're going to support a little bit about everything.
Kaveri has a hope.
You can tell me if it's true.
Is there hope dashed or is it fulfilled?
I would say it's probably fulfilled for most of the field.
Yes.
So if they have, I would say if they have the capacity to do so. There are a lot of community foundations that are either unstaffed or have a very small staff of 1 to 2 folks. And so, they might not be able to take inquiries, so they might be focused on, their specific issue areas and frankly, to becoming sustainable entities as well. But the ones that are larger, they have teams of, that are in charge of, learning about community needs and being in touch with folks. So those, I would say that, once you get to a certain size, then it's a pretty safe bet that they're doing that.
That they're open.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to give an opportunity for questions. So I want to see, does anybody in the our studio audience have a question? You can throw your hand up. We got any? Is there anything on? Yes. Okay. But the studio audience, you're still open. We'll bring you a mic and you can ask questions. Is there one? Okay. Let's go to the live stream then. Susan's
okay.
Monitoring our live stream.
So we first want to say thank you to Chauncey TV for helping us. They are listening and they're helping us with the quality of the live stream. And we have Catherine Barlow on YouTube. So I think Catherine was listening to us last week. She has a comment for you, Tony. I got the book I won last week.
Okay,
really
awesome.
Interesting. Catherine has a comment, question for the Brooklyn Community Foundation. The book was really interesting.
Okay. I'm glad, Catherine. Excellent. Glad
so
you
Catherine wishes to say, Brooklyn used to be its own city. And Catherine also wishes to ask our panelists, I wish our community foundation made larger grants that made bigger impact on our communities and programs and our needs.
So larger grants to fewer organizations or smaller targeted grants to more organizations. I'm going to ask you first, David, because you know the operations.
Yeah, I mean, that's tricky. So it depends. I don't want to dodge the question or anything, but it does depend on the community foundation. So if they have, if they have a really robust grant making program and they're making tons of transactions, depending on the ability of that community foundation to have the funds, frankly, to move, those grants are going to be, depending on the size of the fund that it's coming out from. Or what the focus of the donor might be. Some of these grants could be larger, but some of these grants are also going to be smaller as well, especially if they're from a smaller community foundation.
Yeah.
So
all right.
It's just a tricky question.
How do you fall on that? That's a tough challenge. Right?
So we have a wide range. So our largest grant is $100,000. Our smallest grant is literally $1,000. Our smallest grants are given by our youth fellows. And so they are part of our constituent-led grant-making process where they are making grants to other young people in the community, and they are able to do grants at a level that we would never.
Do you struggle with this? Should we be making fewer large grants or more smaller grants to sort of incubate? Do you struggle with that?
I think it is a struggle. I mean, we've ended up in a place where we're able to do a little bit of each. So we've got tiny grants, we've got large grants. I would say our average grant is like 25 to 30,000. So like meaningful enough to have impact. I think the other piece, I'm just going to say one other thing, which is, I rarely listen to the rules, but I was going to say, we also do multi-year and general operating support. as standard operating practice. And so I think sometimes it's not only about the size of your grant, but it's the way that you're showing up. So what we've heard from our grantees time and time again is that it's important for them to have visibility into the future so that they can plan for 2 or 3 years about staffing and organizational health, which is what we want them to be able to have, and general operating, that they can use the money for whatever comes up. And I think especially looking at the groups that are responding in the, I mean, I'm thinking specifically of our immigrant rights portfolio, but the fact that those grants are able to go towards what is most needed in this moment. There are a lot of things that are showing up for organizations that they may not have planned for, and so it's both the amount and the flexibility.
I see. David, what do we know the average grant size?
For the entire field?
Yeah.
That's a number I don't have on me. But yeah, I was thinking it would be somewhere in the five digits, so it'd be, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $15,000 to $25,000,
okay.
Somewhere in that
okay.
area. Yeah.
Anything else from our live stream? Okay, so let's continue then. I want to move to donor advised funds. Brooklyn Community Foundation has a donor advised fund program.
Mm-hmm.
How do we connect, if I'm a nonprofit seeking grants, how do I get to know what the donor advised fund donors are interested in so that I can make my case?
I mean, I think this is where it's good to be able to approach your community foundation and where be able to talk to them in some ways, irregardless of the purported values or portfolios that are listed on the website. We're always taking these conversations and constantly thinking about what donors we might be able to pull into the grant making to be able to bring opportunities that either we're funding or organizations that we may not necessarily be supporting, but we know would be interest to a donor to them.
Yeah.
For us, it's sort of we're small and growing. We're approaching 60 funds, so we're modest in size. And we actually disperse 65% of our DAF assets on an annual basis. So we're making sure that the money that's coming into BCF is also getting back to the field.
That's a common frustration among nonprofits and among people who study these things, that there's a lot of money sitting in donor advised funds that isn't getting out to nonprofits, that the donor earned an income, charitable income tax deduction in the year that they made their gift to their donor advised fund, but then the money isn't getting out to charities. It's sitting in the donor advised fund. I think the largest is Fidelity, the largest
yeah.
donor advised fund?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Several billion dollars,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And many of the top, I think many of the top 10, like five or six of the top 10 are affiliated with corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Like Fidelity, Schwab,
Vanguard,
mm-hmm. Goldman Sachs, right?
Yeah.
They all have charitable arms that manage the donor advised fund.
Mm-hmm.
If we can segregate out, let's go back to the community foundation now, segregate out the corporations. How common are donor advised fund programs in our community foundation community?
I would say it's super common. it depends. So everything depends on the size of the community foundations, but at the minimum, if you're looking at the smallest community foundations, these are the ones that are under $25 million in assets. About, on average, from our last survey, about 15% of their assets are in donor advised funds. When you get to the largest community foundations, those are the ones that are above $500 million
in assets. That's like Silicon Valley Community Foundation.
Yeah, right? Silicon Valley, New York Community Trust, Chicago, Atlanta.
Okay.
Those guys, on average, about 40%, a little under 40% of their assets are going to be in donor advised funds. And that's being skewed by a couple of the ones that are really heavily invested in donor advised funds or have a lot of their assets in donor advised funds, like Silicon Valley. But that's where the average kind of
There was a lot of press around Steve Ballmer mm-hmm. when he made, almost a $2 billion contribution to a donor advised fund mm-hmm. through the Silicon Valley Community Foundation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that $2 billion is going to skew.
Right.
Skew the average
mm-hmm.
to the donation average. Do we, David, know how common it is for community foundations to be as proactive as Brooklyn is in connecting donors to the nonprofits in the community?
With regards to donor advised funds specifically?
Donor advised fund donors, yeah.
Yeah. So it's a little bit tricky because there are donor relations staff at a lot of these community foundations. So these are the staff that are tasked with being in touch with the donors and getting them connected with the nonprofits that they might be interested in funding. And so that's what I would bring up as a potential touch point for a nonprofit to reach out to a community foundation if there's somebody who's there that might be helpful for them in getting in touch with the donor advice fund donors, then somebody in the donor relations department might be really helpful for them. In terms of a proactive approach, I couldn't say it's super common. I'm not sure how common it is, but my inkling is that it's probably not something that is a proactive approach for most.
Okay. You don't think it's too widespread?
I don't think it's too widespread now.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, let's continue. Kaberi, I want to break down these barriers. Nonprofits, the potential grantees, and the donors who are often totally unknown and unapproachable.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're breaking that down. If we're in a community where the community foundation is open to, to hearing from us about what we do, so we can encourage grants from the donor advised funds to our work, what else should we be doing?
I mean, I think being able to, even if you can't necessarily get an audience or a phone call, email, let the foundation know what you're up to. We're really good about making sure that our information that's coming in from organizations gets to our DAF side of the DAF side of the house. At Brooklyn Community Foundation, 70% of our DAF distributions go back to Brooklyn. So a large percentage of the folks who are choosing to open DAFs at Brooklyn Community Foundation, I think, are doing so both because of our racial justice lens and our commitment to Brooklyn and the way in which we're showing up. And so their dollars aren't necessarily being distributed and flowing elsewhere. They're being reinvested within the community.
That's not because of a policy.
It's not because of a policy, but I think if we were, I mean, we've said this internally, like if all of a sudden it started skewing drastically, one of the questions would be, why not Brooklyn? And then we would need to,
why is it Brooklyn money?
Yeah, we want folks to give where they live, right? And I think the other piece of it is in terms of the fees that come out of our DAFs, 100% of that go into our community fund. So that's also money that's reinvested into Brooklyn. I think there's ways for nonprofits to be able to approach foundations and just build relationships with your CFs the way that you would with any foundation. But then there are other pieces of that, of why a community foundation should be more receptive to your doing that than necessarily an independent foundation that might be like, this is so not within our wheelhouse, we don't have the time or the interest to engage in that way.
Among our audience, studio and live stream, any frustrations? Have you tried to approach your community foundation and were unsuccessful? Any frustrations around donor-advised funds? Have you had successes with donor-advised funds? I mean, it's not all frustration and consternation. Have you had success with donor-advised funds from your community foundation? Has that been working for you? Happy to hear. Anybody in the audience, studio audience? Nothing still? Okay, all right. We're open. Throw your hands up. All right, what more can we say, David, about community foundations and the donor advice fund, trying to help nonprofits get funding?
Well, one thing that I could point out is that donor advice funds are super active grant-making vehicles. So, even though they are growing, in popularity, they're not going anywhere. They're growing in popularity. Their assets are growing by a lot. So if we look at, a comparison between 5 years ago, if we looked at 2013 versus last year, 2017, the assets went from under $20 billion to around $35 billion. So that's a huge jump in 5 years. Gifts jumped from somewhere around $5 billion to somewhere around $6 billion, but grants went from about $2.5 billion to over $5 billion. So grants are growing at a rate that's much higher than the gifts.
And that was in what time?
Between 2013 and 2017.
So it doubled.
It's more than doubled. When you look at the payout rates, between donor advised funds and other funds at most community foundations that take our survey, we're looking at a distribution rate that may be hovering around 5% for most of the community foundation. But when we're looking at donor advised funds specifically, we're looking at double digits. 11, 12, 13% of assets are going back out into the community. So, and that gap widens the larger the community foundation, because they have less in fewer endowed assets. So more of that's going to be passed through and go back out. At the same time, I mentioned the numbers a second ago for 2017, but about $6 billion in gifts and $5 billion in grants. So most of those dollars are going right back out in the same year. I'm just mentioning them as a really hyperactive grant making
vehicle. All right. Yeah. Because that is a common argument is that, as I said earlier, the money is not flowing out of the donor advice funds, that donors are earning a charitable income tax deduction and the money sits in the donor advice fund.
Sure. Yeah. And even with the payout rate issue there too, we could definitely benefit from having better data, because these are numbers that are in the aggregate. So there might be individual donor advised fund accounts that are distributing a majority of their assets or most of their assets in a year, or most of what comes in, but there might be other donor advised funds accounts that aren't moving dollars in a specific year or maybe for a couple of years. There are community foundations out there that are protecting against that a little bit with some of their internal policies. So there's something called variance power that a community foundation can exercise, and effectively what that means is that they have final say.
Yeah, we have jargon jail on.
I know, sorry. Try my best to define it.
Variance power, no, but you were trying to define it, so I'm just, you're on probation.
Yeah, the door was closing, but I snuck my way back out. So effectively, when a donor opens a donor advised fund or donates funds to a donor advised fund, they do forfeit legal ownership over those funds. They belong to the community foundation. So there is a reasonable expectation that when they make a recommendation for a grant, that the community foundation is going to give the grant that they recommend.
It's going to follow, right.
But there's no binding, legal precedent, agreement that says that they have to do what the donor advises. So the reason I bring that up is because if there's a donor who doesn't give a grant for, let's say, 3 or 4 years, depending on the community foundation, that community foundation can then exercise that variance power and select nonprofits that are as close to the donor's original intent as possible, right, and start distributing those funds.
Well, wouldn't they first encourage the donor to make his or her own recommendations, right?
Yes, definitely.
Before they start pulling money out of a fund. Now, you don't seem to have this problem in Brooklyn. You said money is flowing out.
Yeah, right. I mean, and we're doing site visits for folks to be able to engage with organizations. We're learning about organizations to be able to feed them to donors. So that has not been our issue
cool.
there.
Which is promising.
We'll take it.
how common is it that a community foundation would exercise that power?
That's what I mean when I say we can benefit from better data. If we have individual, fund level transaction data, then we can really get at, how many of the funds are, maybe inactive for a year or two, and which are the ones that are the super active ones that are bringing that payout rate up. I would encourage foundations to share their grant making data.
Variance power, that seems pretty draconian. That's we're taking your money and we're giving it to what we think is close to what you say you're interested in.
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to align with their mission.
There'll be a lot of steps before.
Yeah, it's a pretty.
Before that's gonna kick.
For sure. Yeah. Okay. It's a pretty drastic step at the end. Yeah.
All right. Still no question. About how to approach a donor advised fund, about getting money for your nonprofit from a donor advised fund. I'm answering all the questions. I'm that good. I'm like channeling the audience so perfectly. If there are no questions,
okay. Well, I do have a question that I heard from someone a couple of days ago about if you receive money from a donor advised fund. Oftentimes, it appears almost anonymously like ghost money. How do you thank a donor who gave that money? Do you thank that donor, or do you thank the foundation? Do you thank whoever the person is who made the connection? So the donor advised fund, if there is one, is there any process around that that
because
any of you know
just
of?
To set the stage, because the check comes from the community foundation,
right?
And the community foundation is at least under no obligation to tell you the nonprofit who the person is, and maybe they're not even allowed to. So that's the issue. Can
yeah, we, what does that mean for stewardship?
Them? Yeah, right. How can we say thank you to the donor?
We have ways of being able, we have a lot of DAFs where they're like giving circles and they're highly involved, so you would know who they're coming from. And so in that circumstance, I would say you would just reach out and say thank you and cultivate that relationship in that way as you would anything else.
What about the anonymous ones?
The anonymous ones, I would say it's still probably a great idea to be able to send the thank you to the foundation, and I would imagine the foundation would forward it on to the DAF holder. Mm-hmm. We're in service to being able to support the nonprofit sector, right? We want the money to be able to go to Brooklyn nonprofits, and one of the things that we're constantly trying to do
is be able to increase visibility and increase understanding of the work so that more people are compelled to give to these exceptional nonprofits that are doing really important work. So we're, you know, we want to be able to see that relationship flourish and grow. And so I would say that we're on the same side of wanting to make that happen.
Maybe be even a little more proactive and specifically say, please pass this on to the donor who created the fund. And include a little private note, you know, for our donor. Ask the foundation to send that along. We do that in planned giving all the time. Mm-hmm. When okay, now there's a question. We got like 1 minute left. All right, get your question, Tracy. Maybe we get one question. We're going to wrap up with this question. You have to be so concise.
Okay.
I pleaded for questions.
Okay. So this is the first time I'm hearing about donor advisor funds, and I'm still unclear. How do you find out about those funds? Are they listed in the community, are they listed on the website?
So how do you find out what donor advised funds will fund?
Yeah.
I could start at an answer. There are a couple ways.
You have to be so brief.
I'm going to try my best. About 10 years ago, in 2006, there was a, part of the Pension Protection Act said that foundations needed to list out at least a couple of data points about the donor advised funds, so how many they have, how much they've given out from them, how much they've received to them. So you have an idea of how much of their grant-making activity is coming from donor advised funds. They might have a listing on their website, but they usually would have an honor roll on their annual report. So they might call out their top donors, and many of those might be donor advised fund holders, and that might be a good way for you to kind of figure out who among those might have given you that grant, if their name
is
one.
I was just going to say
that's exactly right. So like I've got our Brooklyn Insights, and so you have an entire page of who the funds are, and then we also have snapshots about some spotlighted donors and talking about what their values are and what they're looking for.
We have to stop.
Done.
All right. I'm glad we got one audience question. Thank you so much. It's time for the giveaways. So, live stream and in studio, get your phones. We're going to be giving away a book. I got the first five people who text are going to win a copy of this book, which is Modern Media Relations for Nonprofits, Creating an Effective PR Strategy for Today's World. This is written by two former journalists who were on the show, Peter Panapento and Antoinette Carr. They were on last month. All former journalists. They had to reach media. Okay, so the first thing you need is the number, of course. The number is 252-515-7987. 252-515-7987. And by the way, that area code 252, that's where I have a home, North Carolina. So you can send good thoughts along with your text. I'll tell you what to text in a second, but you have to keep listening to me. 252, yeah, that's Morehead City area code, where the hurricane is hitting right this second. So but it's actually being answered by a service in California. So you'll get an answer. Don't worry, you're not going to get floodwaters back. All right, so the number once again, 252-515-7987. This book is brand new. You're going to get media relations. The first five people to text are going to get a copy of it. And here is what you text. You text, cut the tension with a knife in the room. You text the word community. Community. Okay, that's the giveaway. And it's time for me to thank our guests. Again, Kaberi Banerjee Murthy, Vice President of Programs at the Brooklyn Community Foundation, and David Rosato, Member Services Manager for CF Insights, a service of the Foundation Center. Thanks so much.
Thank
you very much.
For having
me. We can join welcoming and thanking. I should say thank you. Absolutely. Next week, as I said, we're going to be, of course, we're back at the Foundation Center. We're talking about family foundations. How do you get the attention of family foundations when they say they'll contribute only to pre-selected organizations? What do you do? How do you break that down? And what are strategies to keep relationships going after you have, in fact, started them? Talk about all that next week. Same time next week. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled. Tony.ma/Pursuant, capital P. Wegner CPAs,
guiding you beyond the numbers, RegnerCPAs.com. By Telos, that credit card and payment processing, your passive revenue stream, tony.ma/TonyTelos. And by Text to Give, mobile donations made easy, text NPR to 444-999. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Liebowitz is the usually the line producer, but he's not this week. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy. This music is by Scott Stein. And many thanks to here at the Foundation Center. These are the line producers, Tracy Kaufman, Susan Sharoma, and William Lee here at the Foundation Center. Thank you so much. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.